Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today we're interviewing Karen Dahlman, who is the author of The Spirit of Alchemy, Secret Teachings of the Sacral Reunion. Karen is a leading expert on paranormal and metaphysical topics, which she has also written about in The Spirits of Ouija, Four Decades of Communication. She uses this form of communication to communicate with spirit, and has written this in The Spirit of Alchemy to share with you how you can use esoteric Ouija work to further spirit communication. Thank you, Karen, for joining us.
Yeah, thank you, Susan, for having me. Looking forward to our conversation today.
So would you give the listening audience a little bit of your history, how you became involved in spirit communication?
Sure. Well, my story's not too different from a lot of people's story who get involved in this. I had experiences as far back as I can remember of visitations from unseen, well, they were seen to me, but unseen to other people, visitors. So it started really as a real young child, at the age of two, I can remember back. I had a friend, it was a little playmate that would come around and play with me, and nobody else could see him. And I never thought I was creating him or making this up, but I was told that I was probably acting silly and that I was, you know, this was pretend. I said, no, it's not pretend. He's right here. Can you not see him? And so I started that, you know, the level of this friend, and I didn't realize what it was called until I was a lot older. You know, looking back on it, probably in more of my teen years, I realized, oh, that's what people call the imaginary playmate. But I had experiences with spirits throughout my life. Just deceased. I can see them literally, not just in my third eye, but literally out in front of me. And that happens from time to time. I had some really unique experiences of that nature, and found myself really keeping it more private, because when I did speak about it, it was, you know, scorned upon. So what really happened was, to allow myself to understand what was going on, was it was in 1973 when I discovered the Ouija board. And the Ouija board, to your audience, I think most people know what they are, but it's a wooden board or cardboard or masonite board. Nowadays, they're cardboard. They used to be wooden. And they have a little planchette, a little indicator. It looks like a heart shape with a little opening in it. And that you put your hands on it, and with the help of the energy of the spirits, or some people say your own ideomotor, your own fine muscle movements do it. It moves, it slides across this board and spells out messages. So I was introduced to that by some little friends of mine. I was the age of eight. And we started using it to communicate. And they said, well, look who we talked to. And they were talking to a dead sister of theirs. And I didn't even know they had a dead sister. But apparently one of the girls had a twin who died shortly after birth. But what was really amazing, Susan, is that as these children were talking to this child who had died right after birth, was also growing up and was the same age as these girls were. The older girl was 10, and her twin would have been the same age, 10, and was growing up on the other side. And so to me, that just very interesting. And it just really put it in a package for me of, okay, maybe what all these things I experienced wasn't just my imagination, as I was told it was something I was pretending or making up. Maybe there is something more to this. And so at that point, I was hooked at learning to wanting to explore these other dimensions and realms. And and from that point, I just went way, way out there. And I still am to this day, pushing the boundaries of consciousness is what I call it.
Right. Well, you know, many of us who were born with a different set of perceptual reality tools, so to speak, get information from the other side. I can remember when I was less than 5 years old telling people who was going to die, because I would hear it from the other side, and of course they would die. Now, I was very protected, and my family didn't tell me that I was silly or, you know, mentally ill or, you know, all the other things that they can say, but they just sort of, like, didn't say much and just sort of withheld judgment on it. And maybe it's because the genetics run in our family, and I had other relatives who were quite clairvoyant. I think, and my father was very clairvoyant. So I think that they suspended judgment, you know, and just sort of said, well, you know, we'll see what happens, and didn't make me feel like I was somehow not right, which was a blessing. You know, not being born into a real religious family. My parents were Methodist, and we went to church every Sunday, but it wasn't hell and brimstone Southern Baptist, you know, that many of my friends who are clairvoyant, I think Tricia McCannon, who's an author, was brought up in a family that was more, you know, she tells stories of being having problems as a child. So a lot of it's the family you're born into, whether or not they're accepting of the different perceptual stuff.
And yeah, then, you know, bring up a good point about that, because you had this whole history of your family, and they accepted it. You know, it's funny you say that, Susan, because I do too on my mother's side of the family. But yet, she would tell stories about some of their experiences of seances or tea leaf reading, and they had the ability to see visions. And so here I am saying the same thing, but yet it wasn't acceptable for me, because now it was like home. It was close. It wasn't just the distant relatives, I think. And so it's very interesting how, you know, families help shape us in that way.
They do. And, you know, I'm reading another book that talks about how significant, not psychological, but also physical trauma can occur when we are disempowered at an early age, you know, be it a more minor disempowerment, like what you're describing, or, you know, a disempowerment of a relative sexually abusing us, which is a major disempowerment, and then the family not believing that, that, you know, there's a huge thing about not believing the kid, you know, saying, because they don't want to disrupt the family dynamics. You know, if your uncle sexually abuses you and you tell your father, well, he's not, I mean, a lot of times he's likely to just ignore that information and not even, you know, act on it or tell you you don't know what you're talking about. And but that's really, really damaging. So in the early stages, when your family doesn't believe you and doesn't and disempowers you, then this can lead to significant problems later in life. But, you know, I mean, I'm not saying that you had problems, you didn't, but you found the Ouija board that then was a tool. And I found automatic writing. I started doing automatic writing. So it's very similar.
We
both went into it's just a tool you're using. I was bored in high school, so I just used to do automatic writing. You know, I can do two things at once, so I could listen to the lecture and do automatic writing at the same time. So I would do pages and pages of automatic writing with really interesting information coming from the other side, stuff I didn't know, you know. But and the other thing, I don't write in cursive. I print, and the writing came through in cursive. So, you know, I knew it was not coming from me. So, many of us have these stories about finding a tool that then validates what we knew, which was that our perceptual reality is quite different than the average person's perceptual reality.
Yeah, very true. And my guides tell me, I'm in communication with them all the time now, and I also do automatic writing as well. They tell me that a lot of us as children, and they say, especially you, when they talk to me directly about this, they say you had more of an awareness of your higher self, of your connection back to source. And you obviously did too, Susan, and many people that are, that are remembering this stuff as a child, they had that connection, and sometimes it goes away. People forget and tuck it away because they have to, or they don't know what else to do with it. And in my case, I just kept going into it regardless of if there was support. Now, what's funny about this whole thing about my family not wanting to believe me, they were the ones that gave me the Ouija board on Christmas. Santa Claus delivered.
There you go.
And they never signed negative.
Somehow.
Right, exactly. And it was not a bad thing. And so I remember as a child having friends come over to spend the night, you know, little sleepovers with the girlfriends. I remember sometimes they would tell me, my parents said, I can sleep over at your house, but I can't use the Ouija board. And I thought, why?
Right.
That's
silly. Well, that's a lot of fear-based stuff with the Ouija board. That's interesting. Yeah, that's
a lot
very
of fear
true.
Stuff. I didn't have that.
A lot of fear-based.
Yeah. I never had that. And we were practicing Catholics, going to church, and I was going to Bible school, Sunday school,
yeah.
CCD, catechism. I was reciting the rosary. I was doing everything. We had crosses, crucifixes in our rooms. Mm-hmm. It was nothing negative. Nobody said, get that out. It's evil.
Well,
it wasn't.
That's because you're spiritually protected. And I am, too.
Yes,
I never had any negative. I really love Ouija boards. I never had any negative experience at all with Ouija boards or with tarot cards or with automatic writing, because I have spiritual protection, and I know I do, and you know you do, but you know what? When you begin to doubt that you have spiritual protection, when you believe the stories that other people tell you that you are going to be negatively influenced by negative spirits that are going to come through these tools, then you begin to believe that if you're not strong, if you don't know otherwise. Like, we know otherwise that we're fine, you know. But it's really your belief system. If you really believe you can be influenced by the and negative spirits can come through the Ouija board, just like if you're walking down the street, somebody can come up and try to rob you. I mean, there's no difference. But on the other hand, you can't not go outside for the rest of your life because somebody might rob you, you know?
Yeah, no, that's a good point. I mean, there's what I've learned about any of these tools, you know, you mentioned the tarot, and we can throw the pendulum in there, or even EVPs,
anything.
The digital recorder, when people go into haunted spaces. These are neutral devices. There's nothing attributed to them, yet our own beliefs. And once we ascribe meaning to them, that is what we're going to get from it, is that aspect of the meaning. If it's a evil thing, a negative thing, you're going to get that. So these are just neutral devices. And that's the biggest thing I always say about the Ouija board, is that I can take my Ouija board and I can saw it in half. If it's wooden, if it's Masonite, it won't burn. If it's cardboard, I can rip it up. I can burn it. And it's there's nothing wrong. It's just silly. It's just paper, basically compressed paper. That's all it is. What makes it work is ourselves. What makes it
work
is our vibration, our energetic vibration that attracts other like to it, and that allows the communication to occur.
It does. It does. And, you know, there's an example here of belief systems that let's go back into normal life. If you believe that all doctors are really, you know, just in it for the money and really don't know anything about your health and whatever, every doctor you go to will fit into that category. You see?
That's right.
Yeah. So if you believe that all Ouija boards are bad things, every Ouija board you put your hands on is going to result in some negative spirit coming through and confirming that belief for you.
Yeah. You know, what we argue for is what we'll get, if that's what
we
want to believe. Yeah,
that's
quite fascinating. And that works the same with automatic writing, as you mentioned, too. It's like doubt you could do that and have positive things, because that was your mindset, obviously, to do that. And what's really neat, what you said about automatic writing, it was like you were multitasking. You could listen to a lecture, and then on the other hand is writing. And really, that's what it requires, to step aside, to kind of let go and allow without too much thought. My guides call it a quiet ear and a quiet mind. Yeah. And then you can allow the flow of this communication, this communion to come through with your spirit guides, your higher self, with source. Yeah.
Well, it was very important, too, for both of us to engage in these things, because it becomes easier to communicate through these devices. You know, and I'm sure you feel this way too. When you're just doing direct spirit communication, like I had some stuff happen yesterday. It was really funny. But you always wonder, was I making that up? You know, even now, years and years later, after doing this for many, many years, you still think to yourself, well, that information I got yesterday when I was just like, you know, like in my head, was that my thought? Or was that something coming from a spirit? And it's weird to me that we're thinking that even this far in the game, you know. But when you're doing it through automatic writing, or when you're doing it through some other tool, you really separate out that, you know that that's coming from the other side.
Yeah, it becomes more tangible, and it's experiential, yeah. But it becomes more tangible where you really feel the separation from it. And
but
they laugh at me, my guides, and they say, "What makes you think you're so separate from this?" But you're right. With these tools, we can almost displace it in a way, project it out here, so it's not mm-hmm. so. We like separatism. We like compartmentalization as humans. We like things neat mm-hmm. in a little box with a bow on them. And I think that's just our physical nature. That's just how we're created to be that way. And so these tools do, like you said, it allows you to give you that feedback that, wow, this something is happening here. There is this mm-hmm. communication that's happening. Now I got to say this, I do use the Ouija board as well as automatic writing and meditation mm-hmm. and dreams and journaling and all these really creative forms or tools. But I use it to purposely talk to my higher, greater self, which is mm-hmm. an aspect of my personal ego self, but it's so much more, and it's connected back to source. So in a sense, people might say, well, that you're talking to yourself. Well, I am. I'm talking to this wiser aspect of myself. And when people say, well, should I use this tool? And I say, only if you feel called to it. If you feel called to doing a Ouija board, I say, go first and don't communicate with all these discarnate spirits. I said, go to your higher self, connect with that aspect of yourself first. And then you'll start seeing what kinds of information comes through. And in a way that helps you center and ground yourself into using a tool where you don't have these fears either. Because for some reason people have all these fears, and it's the religious and all these other things that come at them before it. But that's one place to start when people begin to use this type of tool.
Yeah. And I wanted to tell people that the reason religion puts these thoughts in your mind is because religion wants to be the primary communication mm-hmm. to this realm through the priests, through the ministers, through the pastors, because that means you've got to go to church, you've got to tithe, you've got to support this institution emotionally and financially, and you can't directly go to your higher self or to your guardian angels or to your guides because it's dangerous. Okay, that's the story that they give you.
That's
and
the key
I
word.
Want to also tell another quick story, which I think you'll like. I was in my car driving along, and I heard my higher self say, "Do you know how you know it's me talking?" And I said, "No, how?" And this is funny. You'll like this. It says, "Because it sounds like you." Isn't that great?
That's cute. Very cute.
You know, it's like your own voice of yourself in your head, but it knows a lot more.
Yeah,
your higher self is going to sound just like you because it is you. But you know, that's like a distinction that you don't really find in the books that you read on higher self. You know, it is really you.
It is really you.
You know that because you just said it. But you know, it sounds like you too. It's not going to sound like. Yeah,
it does. It might just use some grander, fancier language at times, or has some really cool maxims and tenets to share. But no, you're right. It does sound like you. And I can tell the difference between my higher self or if I'm talking to a different spirit guide or I speak a lot to ethereal light beings, a collective group of souls that exist mm-hmm. in light. And so they come through and they're very different. And each spirit guide that comes through, whether it's in my mind, my dreams, writing, mm-hmm. or doing the Ouija board, they have their own unique personalities. But you're right, the higher self reflects mine.
Yeah,
very, very cute. Well, you know, the book, The Spirit of Alchemy, Secret mm-hmm. Teachings of the Sacred Reunion, really explores this concept of how to connect to your divine self, which is your higher self, mm-hmm. and ultimately connect back to source. So I do talk a lot about the religious factions that were around in the day when the alchemists were present practicing their, they called it hermetic or philosophical alchemy, because most people, mm-hmm. let me back up, most people know alchemy is transforming base metals into gold, and yes, that was practice. But what happened alongside of this practice of transforming with these base metals, lead, such as lead, and adding all these processes to it to make the gold, they were doing that. But what mm-hmm. also was happening was this spiritual aspect was happening alongside. They found that not only did they transform the metals and the chemicals, they transformed their soul. They were transforming themselves, and they were connecting into the divine self. They were accessing the higher self and the information that comes from the higher self, and really becoming quite competent people in many ways and regards. And so when the ruling factions get a hold of this, such as it was religion back in those days, that it was the church ruled, these people had to go underground. They had to hide in great secrecy what they were practicing. So they wrote in allegories, they wrote in symbols, signs. They kept it really metaphorical. They had to hide what they were doing for fear of being punished ultimately by death and tortured. So it was became a very secretive thing. And so I wanted to explore this whole notion of personal transformation that can occur out in the open now, because we were allowed to, you know, have the freedom of speech to talk about such things, but back then they didn't. And that's where really a lot of the fears came. As you mentioned, Susan, they wanted to control the populace and not allow people or have people that could go outside and around them and actually have freedom, of ultimate freedom, to really think for themselves. And so this group of people did that, the alchemists, the hermetic scientists, the Gnostics, but they all practice this form of ways to know the divine within themselves, as opposed to having to go through a mediator.
Yeah, I mean, the Catholic Church was the main power center of religion for most of history. And, you know, they not only demanded 10% of what you made, but also would not let the people in the church read the Bible. You know, the Bible was to be read by the clergy within the Catholic Church. So they even kept the books that was why Protestantism was so, I guess, revolutionary, because they wanted the people to read the Bible. You know, they wanted a direct, and then, you know, Christianity branched off from there, where the Bible became the only source of information. You know, it went the other way. You know, it was like the most important thing, and it was literally translated, which is, you know, kind of not the best thing to do either. So, you know, the whole thing then came with the group of the alchemists then going into secret societies. You know, there was all these secret societies that I was a Rosicrucian. I don't know if you ever did that, but, you know, I joined
Very
a
cool.
secret society, and then you start learning all of these things that the alchemists discovered, but you have to pay for it, right? And then now you've got them all in the bookstores. You know, they're all in books like yours and other, you know, the secrets are now just available, but many people don't realize that they're right there in the bookstore. You know, things that people died for.
That's
to keep secret are in the metaphysical bookstores. It's just really kind of exciting how this whole thing evolved to see what, think about how many people died. To pass this information on correctly. And now it's just in the bookstore.
Yep.
So people need to realize that, you know.
It's freely accessible. It's on the internet. It's just a matter of, are you willing to practice it? Are you willing to take it in and know what that means? And yet this work we're talking about, connecting to your higher self and guides, does take practice, and it does take time in terms of really fine tuning it, you know? You and I came into this life with some, definitely some abilities that which everybody has. They just forgot for the most part. Mm-hmm. So that's another reason why I wrote that book, is to help people remember and reclaim what their source knows, what they knew before they came into this world, and what they can still allow to come out in their life now. And it is about these secret practices. But what my guides always tell me is, the secret, and they call it the gold, is always hidden in plain sight, and it's a matter of walking into the bookstore.
That's so true. Yeah.
Right.
So you have a chapter 4 is called Remembering, and when I was waking up, this was often the case. It wasn't so much that I was learning new information, I was remembering information that I knew from previous lives.
That's right. It's interesting how that happens. Now, that chapter specifically gets into the masculine and feminine energies, and I'm not talking about gender. I'm talking about the qualities within ourselves that help create the divine, just the divine within us. And it's these qualities where the masculine's more of the assertive, the task oriented, the forward thinker,
right.
The activist,
logic,
where the
logic,
yeah, yeah logic, where the feminine is more of the embracer, the holder, the mm-hmm. the nurturer, the joy. And so you got to bring those two together within ourselves. Now the alchemists knew this; they knew the mm-hmm. secret to their salvation, and the secret to understanding the philosopher's stone, which is the which is ultimately the gold, which is ultimately going back to and connecting back to the source energy. They knew they had mm-hmm. to bring forth these energies within themselves that were complementary, yet also considered dualistic. So mm-hmm. instead of seeing themselves as just all masculine, they had to bring in this feminine kind of aspect to themselves too. And in their center of their body, their heart chakra is where you brought this energy together, and through that they can start transforming themselves. Now they use the secret language, which they called it the marriage of the Red King to the White Queen. It was mm-hmm. a sacred marriage of the king and queen. But they knew what that really meant. That really meant finding the dualistic nature within themselves and coming to a kind of equilibrium, balance. I hate the word balance though, because right. I don't want to say it's equal. It's always equal. It's more of a equilibrium. It's a back and forth. It's a give and take, that like the yin and yang. And mm-hmm. so it was a matter of them coming to terms with that within themselves. And so they just saw it as the king and the queen, the male, the female, knowing that right. when those parts within themselves came together, they would give birth ultimately to the philosopher's stone, which is the third mm-hmm. part. Something new emerges when two come together. When right. when a mother and father come together and have a baby, there's your newness is the baby. Well, they saw it as nurturing this creative form within themselves. And it came through first, it was called the lesser stone. They knew they had to work on themselves some more. Then as they worked on themselves some more, they can bring forth now the philosopher's stone. And that ultimately was the gold within themselves. They worked through all the leaden objects and problems within their life, within themselves, mm-hmm. all the turmoil that we all have in our minds, our head, our ruminating thoughts, learn to silence mm-hmm. that and learn to give birth to this connection to source. It was really right. quite a beautiful thing they were doing. And in the Rosicrucians, I know, talk about this, and so do the Masons, some of these mm-hmm. aspects that we're talking about right now.
Yeah, and really, if you take it a step further, once you balance everything, it's balance of everything. It's not, and it's actually balance
right.
of left, right brain and parasympathetic, sympathetic nervous system. It's everything. Once that's totally balanced, then you're able to consciously travel in your Merkaba light body.
Mm-hmm.
That's the bilocation that the masters do and the initiates do, you see.
You oh, yeah.
To be able to appear in other places. Okay.
That's right. And the alchemists were able to do that.
That is how you transcend death. That's exactly how you transcend death. Because when your physical body leaves, your consciousness goes into your light body but stays alive. You know, you actively transcend death that way.
Yeah. And that was that's right. And that was their goal. They,
yeah.
You could call it a star tetrahedron or the Merkaba. It's the
Merkaba,
same form,
yeah.
And that's you've got the four-dimensional one. And in
right.
fact, on the front of the cover of the book, there's a star tetrahedron there representing
uh-huh.
the aspects of the upper chakras, lower chakras, the dualism coming together in this form
mm-hmm.
that happens at the heart. Now, they understood all this, so that's what some of the symbolism they used. And they mm-hmm. were transcending, ultimately, a death of themselves. They call it the king dying off. That was part of the process of the alchemical process, where you have to put mm-hmm. to death the king, the old king, the old ruler, which is the old ruler within ourselves, put to death
right.
that part of us that's no longer needed, that kept us in fear, that kept us from seeing that light. And so in a way, they did merge into their light bodies. That was their goal, and they learned to do that while they were still alive. And you're
right.
and ultimately,
and,
you're
and
talking about doing it to move through life.
And let me tie this to something that's occurring right now called the Ascension.
Mm-hmm.
The Luciferian Rebellion occurred 200,000 years ago, and when it occurred, a energy was put around this planet along with the, I think, 30-some-odd other planets that were involved in the Luciferian Rebellion. So those worlds became free will worlds rather than the normal, which is not free will. And basically, when we come into this free will zone, we forget who we are unless we're very spiritually evolved, like the Dalai Lama. So when we forget who we are, when we die, we think we die, okay, because we don't take it with us, right? We really do take it with us, though, and if you could see us on the other side, everything's okay, but we don't remember doing that. But when the ascension occurs, that veil's going to come off. And so that will be, it's almost like we always really did take everything with us to the other side, but we just didn't remember to do it, and that's why we thought we died. But after the ascension, we'll be able to know that we're taking it over there and remember it when we come back, you see. It's like the veil will be gone. The veil of forgetfulness is what they call it, will be gone. And so we'll come in knowing a lot more, and that will be very protective. You won't have to learn everything all over again. You see, you'll be able to remember what you learned before, and you'll be at a much higher level and won't have to make so many of the same mistakes again.
Yeah, there'll be that awareness, that consciousness of this connection, and we're talking about this connection back to source, of where you really came from. And we get glimpses of it, and the best way to get your own glimpses of it is through your dreams. And when you're back in your dream, you really are rested, nested inside of this higher self that's connected to source. Mm-hmm. You're uninhibited and allowing yourself to rest into that energy. And so that's where a lot of times the deceased will come and visit, which we call the deceased. My spirit guides say they don't really understand this term death that we always use, because like what you just said, it's a falsity. It doesn't happen. We just don't remember our transition.
We believe it.
We believe it. We believe this story.
Exactly. And you have a good quote here in your book from Hamlet about that. Nothing is either good nor bad, but thinking makes it so.
Yeah, that's from Hamlet.
So we think death is bad. Well,
that's
death
right.
isn't bad. I mean, would you really want to keep growing older and older and older? No.
Right. Because it's a quality of life, right? It's a quality of life.
Yeah, exactly. I think
if the quality of life was like 300 years and you were, had all your capacities
Besides
available.
That, if nobody ever died on Earth, what would Earth be like?
Right.
It would be a living hell.
Talk about overpopulation.
Yeah, really. You wouldn't be able to move.
There's so much more for us to do in other realms and other dimensions that we just can't even grasp. And we may get glimpses of it from time to time. And that's really my goal. My mission is to push these boundaries of consciousness and to really reach out and to remember, reclaim, to understand, to communicate, to be in communion with these other dimensions, these other energies that it's just very natural to do and to be. And even as a child, even though, I wasn't believed in what I was experiencing, it didn't matter. There was such a drive in me to understand and to know these different realms. And so that's where my focus stays to this day. I'm still pursuing all these other communications and connections to the unseen, if you will call it the unseen. So they're not that unseen sometimes.
So in chapter 7, you talk about the underworld, and I like the way you describe it as the deepest level of consciousness within our inner world, because we do shove things down. Things that we don't want to think about get shoved down. You want to explain how that happens and then how they actually come back up and cause disease?
They
don't stay down there, do they?
Oh, no, they don't. We think they do. I think, what really happens, I broke this book into different sections as if we were going and traveling through a world. We have the upper world, we have the inner world, we have the underworld, and then you have, again, you come back out into the upper world. But it's truly a process that mythology talks about, and all the hero's journey of like Gilgamesh, they all have to go into some kind of inner space. They have to go on this journey that takes them away from their home, and they have to try to find some answer, something that's calling them to understand their life. And so this section about the underworld is, I really encourage people to go within themselves. This underworld is a literal place within ourselves where we, as you said, Susan, we try to maybe sweep sometimes the stuff under the carpet, put a lock on that door where skeletons are. And it doesn't have to be such really negative things. But some things we forgot. And it's sometimes it's about going and reclaiming that. Now, My background is a psychotherapist. I worked with people who had some of the most extreme psychological issues, and this is what we call now dissociative identity disorder. Back then, it was multiple personality disorder, and these people are very good at compartmentalizing and having these other personalities within themselves that don't even know each other they exist, and that's an extreme case of what I'm talking about. But we all have within ourselves these aspects that we've forgotten, tucked away. It may just been like you forgot you had an imaginary playmate. That's simple. Or it could be some, maybe you had abuse, as you mentioned, an uncle abusing, sexually abusing a child. And when we, these things are stuck within ourselves, it really disempowers us. It disengages us from our center. It disengages us from being in communication with this greater part of ourselves we've been talking about today. Right. And so what we go into the underworld, I really try to look at it as this is going to be a journey no different than the hero or the heroine in these mythological stories, where we're going to uncover, turn over these stones and see what it is that's there, and not see it as a negative thing, although there could be pain and fear. And often during this stage, we will feel the pain. We will have emotional breakdowns. We will have issues that'll bubble up to the surface. But knowing that while we do this, those items really are a part of ourselves. We can't extract it. We really need to find a way to integrate it, because those are parts that either protected us during the painful times, and that's what multiple personality disorder is, those different alters that take over different parts of the personality protect that child when they're going through horrific abuse. And so these parts within ourselves that we see as so bad and ugly are truly not demons, they're daemons. They're actually part of ourself that can help ourselves. So I really try to look at what's inside ourself as not as being bad, although there's maybe some quote unquote bad things we think we've done, and that may be true, but we can find out what, where, why, how, and begin to integrate that back into our lives and accept it as this was a part of myself that I needed to get through that aspect of my life. And so not to turn ourselves on anymore, but to now, what would this part like to say to me? What is this part? What has this part been holding of myself that I have been afraid to look at? And so it becomes this process of really allowing yourself to reconnect. You reconnect to all these different aspects of yourself, which ultimately will create this empowered, I call it being in your center, where you don't have these fears and what people tell you from outside don't scare you anymore, because you really know what's inside you. What's inside you really is this great strength built upon all these experiences that we have that we call life.
That's true. That's very true.
Yeah.
So your next chapter is on let's see here, on illusions, chapter 8.
Oh yeah.
You want to talk a little bit about the nature of nothing and the nature of dualism?
Yeah, you know, when we get into the underworld, the way we can break through these things, that these locks that we've placed there, and start to get into what's really inside ourselves, we have to break through the illusions. There are a lot of illusions, and I sort out quite a few of them in this book, and I start with the nature of nothingness. And the nature of nothingness is really there's a positive charge and a negative charge to every single thing that's alive in the world. This is the energetic vibration makeup that creates us. It's in our atoms. It's down to the smallest particles within ourselves that vibrates. And when these two come together, they cancel each other out, which creates neutrality. Neutrality is really the basis of every single thing. It's once we ascribe meaning to it, just like that quote we just read from Shakespeare, and just like we said, everything is until we ascribe meaning to it, and we talked about the Ouija board and the automatic writing and tarot cards. It's once you ascribe meaning to either the positive side of the charge or the negative side of the charge, then you're going to be creating that resistance, that expectation to happen. So when I talk about nothingness, I'm really talking about neutrality. And neutrality is nothingness. Nothingness doesn't mean nothing exists. It doesn't mean it's an empty vacuum. What it means is it's just in a space of creativity. It's a space of potentiality of creativity. It's in a space of where we can take that basis that form the positive and negative charge and create it into something. An example, I'll use the Ouija board as an example. And I think I used that in the book as well. The Ouija board, again, is a neutral device, yet people want to ascribe some kind of meaning to it. Now, I ascribe a positive meaning to it. That's the same. That's no different than ascribing a negative meaning to it. But the board itself is just neutral. It has a negative charge and a positive charge, which cancels it out into nothing. It is nothing. It is inanimate. It is nothing other than just particles vibrating at either with the positive and negative together. The potentiality for it to become something that a tool that I can use, the potentiality for me to use it as a tool, then asks me to put my attention on these charges. Now, if I put my attention on, oh, it's evil, on the negative charge, then what happens is everything over on the positive side moves from that side of the spectrum. You've got evil, you got evil one side, positive on one side, negative and positive. Let's use negative, positive. Everything has to move from one side. So it moves from the positive, and all the attention has to now flow. Ooh, over to the other side, so that's your experience you're going to get. So if you come to the board with a neutral stance, like this is a tool, I'm going to try to use it, and you're just neutral about it, you're going to find that more than likely you're going to go and gravitate. All the energy is going to move from the negative charge over to the positive charge is what you're going to find. So it's just a matter of really breaking through some of these illusions we've been taught in life that things have to be good or bad, because they're not. They exist together.
Yeah, I'm part of a book. There's about 40 co-authors talking about optimism. And you know, optimism is, the editor is Stephanie Marone and Dawson Church, but there's a whole bunch of people in the book like Prince Charles and Jimmy Carter and Queen Noor and Deepak Chopra. And, you know, there's a whole bunch of different people in the book talking
Very
about
exciting.
Optimism. It really is, because the optimism principle is similar to what you just described. But it encompasses all of life, you know. If you are always pessimistic and always see the bad things, then that is, in general, what's going to happen. You know, again, of the quantum choices out there, you know, you prime it toward the negative happening. Whereas if you can, you know, stay neutral or even go the other way, expect the positive, then that's called optimism, and that is what will manifest in your life. And so you have all these different, really, these people from different realms of life, you know, different categories of what they specialize in, talking about optimism and the formula for how to do it, which is, you know, it's very similar to what you just described.
Yeah, and that's gonna be a neat book, by the way, because if you have everybody in their different endeavors and backgrounds, to see how it affects, what we're talking about here today is really holistic. It's not just one thing; it affects everything. It becomes your worldview. It becomes the way you move about the world, and the way your life expands from your center is through this how you tend to think about life. You know, what color are your glasses you're going to put on? Are they rose colored or are they dark, you know, what is it they're going to be? And so I think life it can definitely be tough. It has its challenges. That's what life is about. That's what it's about, to be in this realm of physical density, is to experience ourselves as a human being and not remember everything. And it can be challenging. And I say, why make it even harder on ourselves? So if there's tools out there, such as these books in the bookstore that we can find, or the internet, or having conversations as we're having today, why not use them? Because what we are doing in the myopic part of our life, we're doing it out there in a larger part of our life. It affects every aspect of our life. So I say the smallest thing you can do is just to wake up in the morning and say, I have a little saying I like to say, it's a beautiful day in every way. How may I serve? How may I play? It's a great way just to start my day. And from that, everything else can tumble out from that space, as opposed to getting up and saying, oh my God, I got to get up and do this, go to work and blah, 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 get in my car, go to the traffic.
I don't want to do that. Yeah, right.
Then it sets the stage. So these things we're talking about are usable, are very practical in our everyday life. And then they will set up how our life is going to be run that day, and really how you're going to live your life.
And it's also interpretation. I tend not to judge things when they come up. When something happens, I tend just to look at it and say, okay, let me, and then I go more to source, like you say, through your higher self and say, okay, why is this coming up now and what is it that I need to learn from it? And rather than, you know, just moaning, oh, gee, this bad thing has happened, and, you know, and judging it and feeling sorry for yourself and everything. You know, that's the other behavior you could do. It just doesn't get you anywhere. So, and then often what I hear or what I learn is that sometimes it has nothing to do with me. Sometimes it's a lesson for somebody else involved. I'm often told that, you know, don't worry, you'll be taken care of. This doesn't apply to you. This is for the other person involved. And then, which makes sense, you know, because we do come in to help other people.
That's right.
You know, like I might have somebody, an employee who's stealing from me, and I can say, oh, gee, you know, why do I have to deal with this again? You know, I don't steal from anybody. Why do I have to deal with this? And then the answer is, well, no, it's because you agreed on a higher level to help them quit stealing, and you're going to catch them every time. So,
right.
You know, they're here until you help them learn this lesson. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
You know, that's all right. I guess then I better double my efforts to help them learn that lesson, you know.
Yeah, we forget what we signed up for when we come here. That's part of it.
It's not always about you, you know.
Yeah, it's not.
It's not always about you.
It's not always personal. It's right. And
that's
a great
right.
way to look at it,
that's
too,
right.
and say, what can I learn from the situation, and where can I step back and also observe and learn from vicariously from the other person?
Right.
It's true. We don't always know those little agreements we had with everybody.
Yeah.
And everybody in our life,
we
don't remember them. And so it's these soul contracts kind of thing. And so it's nice to step back and take a deep breath before we get sometimes too obsessed with what just happened. I think that's great information.
Well, life isn't perfect. I mean, life is not, you know, life can be messy. Like you said, it can be messy. But in the end, I know that I am always protected. I know that I am always, you know, going to come out smelling like a rose in the end. Okay, I know this because it's happened so often that, you know, when you think things are bad, but then they're really not. They're really very good, and the things that came out of something bad were much better than the things that you had to suffer through. You know, in other words, like, okay, so it cost you some money, but here we're going to give you this money on the other side of things just free and clear because you went through that, you see. It's like
really
didn't lose anything. We just gifted you with all this money. You know, and that was to make up for that. You know, okay, well, then I really didn't lose any money. Okay, so, you know, then you realize that everything does come back around. You know, it's not.
It's funny because hindsight's great. Makes me laugh because you're right. Hindsight will show us all. And so we have to start learning from our track records. In other words, what you're talking about here is as we get older, we start to learn. We start to think, wow, okay, that wasn't so bad that last time. And that's a realistic way, if we can use that word, to look at things, because things do always. Everything, as my guide says, about evolution, it's always for your better evolution and growth. And so what we may not understand is something's happening. We put it into, oh, that must be a horrible thing that just happened. I mean, like you mentioned, you lost all this money. But the truth is maybe you lost it all so somebody else could use it. So on the backside, you will really have a huge gain and you'll even get more back because some other new endeavor will come to you. That is so true. And I can see how that's even happened. That specific incident has even happened in my own life. And it's just, and I'm sure it's happened in a lot of people's life, but we don't know it when we're in the throes of it. But the key is not to get upset when we're in the throes. Yes,
we're
human.
And don't judge too quickly.
Yeah.
You know, I think we judge quickly that things are bad or we're unlucky or we're this or we're that. And it's not about, I mean, as I said before, it's not about you, just you, you know. There's a bigger play. We're on a stage and there's many actors, you know. So there's other things to consider than just you, you know. So you got to expand outward.
That's right. That's right. And the judgment, if we can just drop that, because the judgment is what takes you in taking it out of neutrality. Taking it out of nothingness and all of a sudden ascribing a meaning to it. And you ascribe a meaning to something, it may not be the real meaning that it's supposed to be. That's the gold hidden in plain sight. That's the work of the alchemist. The alchemist would not judge it, would just keep going with the process, see where it took them. And so that's what we need to do in our life. We need to look at our life more alchemistically and see it as get into a neutral space. Try to reserve judgment and try to make those. And when you do that, you can make that connection back to your center, back to your source.
and be able to make better decisions sometimes, be able to have more synchronistic events happen. Synchronicity is happening all the time, but the key is when we step back and forgo the judgment, forgo the meaning of it always, and about ourselves, make it personal, as you mentioned, we can automatically, we start seeing more of these connections, these interconnections between us and others, and the synchronistic things that happen around us. It becomes more, life becomes more magical when we can do that. Now, easier said than done. It does require practice. And, you know, I was going to ask you, Susan, what I thought might be a good thing to talk about before, I know we're ending, but the idea of you're saying you feel very safe and protected, and so do I. Maybe that might help to just share that a little bit, what that basis is built upon.
Well, I think both of us were born with a connection to our higher self. We were born with that connection, which is not always the case. Sometimes sometimes you're in the process of establishing that connection. And that's why I think your book would be important for people to read, The Spirit of Alchemy, Secret Teachings of the Sacred Reunion. Like, I'm looking at the chapter on the higher self and source.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that is an important chapter for people to read that are involved in this connection. Once you have that connection, however, then when you're born again, you do have more information coming in. You do have that connection established, and you do have an incredible amount of spiritual protection. I've told the story before on the show where I was in sixth grade, and a 12th grader tried to rape me at knife point. And I just, a calm came over me. I knew that he had abducted me and dragged me up the stairs in a high school I was attending with my parents at a square dance. I went out to get a drink of water, and he abducted me. And I just, a calm came over me, and I saw very clearly to kick him in the groin, which I did. And he dropped a knife, and I ran, and he chased me. Well, he was stupid because I was a fast runner. I got down there, and he got caught. Okay? So, I mean, where is it written that a sixth grader can get away from a 12th grader with a knife? I mean, where is that ever even considered? You know, and he was a known sexual offender. Mm-hmm. So, or he had a history of it anyway. So basically, that's the kind of protection we're talking here. And yes, I did need to pay attention, and yes, I did need to take some action, because you do when you're in a situation like that. But Deepak Chopra talked about the same thing. He had somebody broke into his apartment, I think in Boston, and it was a prisoner that had escaped prison that was a murderer, and Deepak came in with a baseball bat and hit him. Well, Deepak had to know that in that case you had to take action, okay? But another time when some 15-year-old tried to rob him at gunpoint or knife point, I can't remember which, I think it was gunpoint, he talked the kids down. There were two kids, you know. He talked them down, and he was able to get out of it without hurting them, you know. So the idea that Deepak's putting forth is you follow your higher guidance, you know.
That's right.
In one
you
case,
did too.
You do have to take violent action against somebody trying to do something to you or a loved one. But in other cases, you do something else. You don't, you know, you don't take violent action against a 15-year-old that's just confused and, you know, really not a hardened criminal yet. So,
yeah,
you know, you do have to follow your guidance. And obviously Deepak was born with the same kind of connection that we have. I mean, he was born probably even at a higher level. I actually interviewed Deepak on a TV show that I had. So I met him personally, and he's got the energy field of someone who's really connected, okay? I can tell you that.
Well, he's done a lot of work, too, and his background, from where he came and his family, he was very much into meditation, and he's a proponent of that, And meditation is the idea of silencing our mind, having a quiet mind and a quiet ear. Mm-hmm. What really allows us to hear these subtle voices and these subtle influences. So I highly recommend that to people, too. That helps strengthen this connection to your higher self. It really helps strengthen.
It's very important. Well, we are at the end of our hour. Would you like to give your contact information?
Sure. Thank you. Yeah. So if people want to find me, you can go online to the website, which is Karen A. Dahlman, DAHLMAN.com. You can find me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Google Plus, all under Karen A. Dahlman. And I have three books that I've written with the help of my spirit guides. And mm-hmm. In this last book, The Spirit of Alchemy, is all about connecting to your higher self, how to do that, how to make that connection. And you can find that book in Amazon, any of your local bookstores, and also on my website if you prefer an autographed copy. But come by and say hello. Come join me on Facebook.
Great.
I'd love to have you.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today, Karen. It's been a delightful conversation, and I highly recommend your book for anyone who is looking to establish or deepen that connection to Source through their higher self. I think that is incredibly protective. I think that it makes life a lot easier. You're certainly a lot happier. And you're not dependent on external things like money, relationships, even health. Even when my health's bad, I don't go into a deep depression. You know, I'm in a place where I know that it's not as bad as it might feel at the point.
That's right.
Point in time,
yeah,
you know,
it brings you solace. It brings you solace and comfort having these connections.
It does, even with health problems. And
that's
right. We all have problems in some of these areas intermittently. So it's well worth doing. And thank you very much for writing your book.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you, Susan. It's great talking to you today, too. And I appreciate your show. Thank you.
All righty. Well, this is Dr. Susan Kolb. We've been interviewing Karen Dahlman on the book, The Spirit of Alchemy. And next week we will, let's see. I don't know exactly what we're doing next week. We're doing shamanic transformations with Isaac Berry. And then the next week, I've already done this show. It was a great show, Celebrities in Spirit with Athena Starr. We talked to Johnny Carson. We talked to Diana. We talked to Gandhi, all of these different spirits coming back and telling us what they're doing now. And what they would have done different in their lives, which is a very interesting book. This is Dr. Susan Kolb with Temple of Health Radio Show. Please join us next week.